Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about terrorism, and with it, our focus shifts away from interstate conflict to other forms of political violence. On the first slide, as always, I lay out the goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to provide a definition of terrorism. That's a definition, not the definition, because there are literally hundreds of them. We'll spend some time talking about the controversies. Second, I'm going to discuss whether terrorism can be effective. Many believe it cannot, and have even claimed to provide evidence to that effect. However, I'm going to prove to you that it would look like terrorism doesn't work, even if we assume that it does. Finally, I'll discuss five different ways that terrorism might allow a group to achieve its goals, or at least put them in a better position to do so later on. Turn to the second slide, where you'll find the definition we'll be using. For our purposes, terrorism is nothing more nor less than politically motivated violence occurring outside of combat. Let's unpack that a bit. There are several things there that people might take issue with, both in terms of what's included and what isn't. Just about the only thing everyone agrees on is that terrorism is violent. The politically motivated part? Most would agree, but not everyone would, because that implies that the ultimate goal is a change to some policy. And while many do think that is what the groups we all think of as engaging in terrorism are after, myself included, I have to at least acknowledge that some people think that these groups aren't after anything more than killing as many of their enemies as possible. To me, that sounds less like an attempt to understand international relations than to reassure people that your moral compass is functioning properly, and or suggest that the only possible response is a military one. Which is understandable, but not what I look for in a definition. Besides, even if some violence truly is senseless, there's too much of a pattern overall in terms of when attacks occur and where for us to think they're always, or even generally, an end unto themselves. Okay, what else do people disagree over? Well, I'm not aware of any definition of terrorism that includes combat fatalities, but there nonetheless is some disagreement about the targets. Specifically, there's the question of whether terrorism definitionally targets civilians. Are attacks on government offices terrorism, or an act of war, or something else altogether? Does it matter if those employees are members of the military or police? To some, it does. I'm not sure that it should, though, unless you're trying to establish some sort of hierarchy of tragedy, to say that it was somehow more wrong for Al-Qaeda to target the World Trade Center than the Pentagon. I'm not interested in those sorts of games. Some definitions state that terrorism is carried out by non-state actors. Others take issue with this, believing that it legitimizes atrocities carried out by governments. That is, we know that governments sometimes target non-combatants intentionally with the goal of spreading fear and thus acquiescence. Does that qualify as terrorism, or does it belong to a separate category? Reasonable people disagree about that. On the one hand, our explanations for violence carried out by non-state actors don't always apply as well to governments. So, even if both qualify as terrorism, it still makes sense to analyze them separately. On the other, because terrorism is often treated as a synonym for evil, saying that governments are never guilty of it because they can't be, by definition, seems like a political act. Make of that what you will. just know that this lecture is going to focus on terrorist acts carried out by non-state actors. But whether that's because terrorism definitionally only involves non-state actors, or because this lecture would need to be a whole lot longer if it was going to cover the other sort, and would end up echoing a lot of what I said in the optional lecture on human rights anyway, you can decide for yourself. I'm also only going to focus on organized behavior, such as might occur in the context of a broader campaign against a government. I won't exclude lone wolf terrorism from our definition, but I will from subsequent attempts at explanation. I'm just not sure that international relations has a whole lot to say about isolated incidents involving mentally unstable individuals, even if these incidents appear to be politically motivated in some very broad sense. If you want to understand that sort of thing, you probably need to look to psychology or criminology. Finally, many definitions explicitly state that terrorism aims to intimidate, coerce, or spread fear. While I think that's often true, as we'll discuss later, there have been attacks that didn't really seem designed to do this, yet which still feel like they should qualify as terrorism. We'll talk more about the different goals terrorists might seek to achieve by carrying out their attacks later in the lecture. One important thing to note before we move on is that terrorism has been carried out by a wider range of groups in support of more causes than many people appreciate. At this moment in history, terrorism is often associated almost exclusively with radical Islam. But Christians, Jews, and Buddhists have resorted to terrorism, as have secular groups. It has been associated with nationalism, separatism, environmentalism, Marxism, anarchism, and probably a few other isms that aren't coming to mind at the moment. No matter what your politics or your religious beliefs, or lack thereof, it is a near certainty that someone has carried out violence against non-combatants in the name of a cause you support. If I cited specific examples chosen for you based on your beliefs, you might argue that the victims weren't really innocent because they were complicit in an unjust or immoral system. That's fine. This isn't a lecture about the ethics of war or the conditions under which violence can be morally justified. My point is just that whatever position you take on such matters, you should view terrorism as a tactic. Nothing more or less. One that has been chosen by a wide range of actors. You should probably also know that several surveys have found that Muslims are less likely to agree with the statement, "Violence against civilians is sometimes justified," than are Christians or Jews. And within the Muslim world, religiosity, how devout someone is negatively associated with support for terrorism, at least according to several recent studies. We can argue until we're blue in the face about whether Islam is a religion of peace, whatever that even means, and what it does or doesn't say in the Quran, though it's worth pointing out that there's some pretty bloodthirsty stuff in the Bible, and when you read those parts to Westerners and ask them to identify the source, they'll almost invariably say the Quran. But that's really besides the point. All the available evidence suggests that if you want to know whether someone supports terrorism or not, you should ask about their politics, not their faith. Okay, that's all I have to say about what terrorism is, who it targets, and who carries it out. Let's talk about whether it's effective. As I said at the start of the lecture, many believe that it is not. I've heard a lot of people say that terrorism doesn't work, with the same air of authority and lack of evidence as one might use to say that crime doesn't pay. And I think it's every bit as much an example of wishful thinking. What do you mean crime doesn't pay? Does anyone over the age of 5 actually believe that? Or is that just a comforting fiction, something you tell yourself because you wish it was true, and it helps put even more distance between you and the bad guys. Not only are they immoral, but they're stupid too, because they don't realize they'll never get what they want if they go about things that way. Sorry, but that's nonsense. The Tooth Fairy isn't real either. Okay, I'm being a bit flip, but seriously, psychology tells us that some people need to believe we live in a just world, that people get what they deserve. That need can blind us to obvious truths. And that's nothing to be ashamed of, but it is something to be aware of, something we ought to try our best to overcome. I'm now going to prove to you that even if we assume that violence always increases the chances of getting what you want, it might not look that way when we analyze observational data, when we look at the real world and ask how often those who resort to violence get what they want compared to those who choose peace. So, yes, some have found that nonviolence has a better success rate, or that few terrorist groups have achieved their fullest objectives. But I'm about to show you that we'd expect to find exactly those patterns anyway, so we can't read too much into them. On the third slide, you'll find a model of government coercion. As usual, we have two players, but we're calling them something different. Instead of C and D for challenger and defender, we have D and G for dissatisfied group and a government whose policies they oppose. And the game begins with D deciding how they want to go about pressuring G to change those policies, peacefully or with violence. Regardless of which path D takes, G then has to decide whether to give in or to resist, under the assumption that the latter simply means that the standoff continues. It's still possible that the government will be forced to make concessions farther on down the road, and we'll assume they do so with probability rho. That's the funny-looking symbol you see there on the slide. We could, of course, have the game continue and only allow D to get what it wants if G chooses to give it to them, but I've analyzed such models, and under very reasonable assumptions, the results are basically the same as what you'll see here. So, for simplicity, we're just going to say that there's some chance that G would eventually choose, of their own volition, to give in to D's demands, without explicitly modeling that choice. Finally, because the whole point of this exercise is to show you that it would look like terrorism isn't very effective, even if we assumed that it was, we're going to assume that rho v, or the probability that the government eventually gives in when the dissatisfied group chooses violence, is greater than rho p, or the probability that the government eventually gives in when the group chose a more peaceful path. There are also some cost terms. If the standoff is not resolved immediately, then both sides incur some cost, represented by kappa. And if violence takes place, regardless of whether the government gives in to the group's demands or not, both sides incur costs I've chosen to represent with C's. From here, you should be able to make sense of the table below, which provides the utilities each actor receives at each outcome. For example, if D pressures G peacefully and G gives in, then D gets 1 and G is left with nothing. We don't need to bother with X's here, though nothing much would change if we did. If D chose peace, but G resisted, then the dissatisfied group would get rho P minus kappa d, while the government would get 1 minus rho p minus kappa g, and so on. You might want to hit pause here and take a minute to look over the table so that everything makes sense to you, but I'm not going to explain each outcome individually. Let's talk about what happens in equilibrium. There are three possibilities. One is that G gives in no matter what, in which case D chooses the high road because violence is costly and they've no need to resort to it. This is the only possibility when kappa G is greater than or equal to 1 minus rho p, or when the government sees the cost of a prolonged crisis as being even greater than the probability of them maintaining the status quo. That's what 1 minus rho represents. In other words, when the government isn't terribly resolved, the group chooses nonviolent protest, civil disobedience, or whatever, because there's no need to kill anyone to get what they want. Another possibility is that G only gives in to violence. In that case, we of course expect the group to attack. And this is the only possibility when kappa G falls in between the probability of G maintaining the status quo in response to violence and the probability of them doing so when D pressures them peacefully. Finally, G might resist no matter what D does. In those cases, D chooses violence if and only if the benefit, in terms of increasing the odds of getting what they want, outweighs the cost. This is the only possibility when the government is highly resolved, or when they don't feel as though they lose much utility by letting the crisis continue relative to the odds of maintaining the status quo. Now let's put some structure on rho. In the lecture on information problems, I told you that we could assume that war outcomes reflect how good each side is at blowing stuff up. We might tell a similar story here. Suppose that rho p is equal to alpha d over alpha d plus alpha g, where alpha stands for the general ability to get your way, how politically effective you are. And suppose that rho v is the same, except that we add some constant v for the benefit of violence to alpha d. What would that tell us? That terrorism is a weapon of the weak. I'm speaking a bit loosely here. The model doesn't specify who the dissatisfied group targets if they go down that path. It could just as easily be applied to civil wars as terror attacks. But we'll talk more about that in another lecture. For now, let's use some simple numerical examples to illustrate the point. Suppose alpha d is 2, and alpha g is 8, indicating that the group is not very good at getting their way, at least compared to the government. And suppose further that v is equal to 1. Then rho p would be 0.2, because 2 over 2 plus 8 is 2 over 10, and 2 tenths in decimal form is 0.2. And rho v would be approximately 0.27, 3 divided by 11. Resorting to violence, then, would increase the group's chance of getting what they want by a fair amount, so they're likely to go down that path, but it's worth noting that they're still unlikely to succeed overall. Less unlikely than if they'd chosen peace, but unlikely. Now compare that scenario to one where alpha d is 5. Here, the group is still at a disadvantage relative to the government, but not by nearly as much. Now, rho p is a respectable 0.33, 5 over 5 plus 10, or 1/3. And rho v is only a little bigger at 0.375. Here, there's a lot less to be gained by killing, about half as much as before. More formally, the difference between 0.375 and 0.33 is 60% as big as the difference between 0.2 and 0.27. So it's a lot more likely that the dissatisfied group will decide that the cost of conflict is one that isn't worth paying, meaning that violence is more likely to be chosen by groups that are less able to get their way overall. If every group fell into one of these two scenarios, and the cost of carrying out violence was always 0.05, an extreme simplification, but a useful one, we'd find roughly a quarter of terrorist groups achieving their objectives, and a third of peaceful protest movements doing the same, leading us to conclude that the more noble path is also the more effective one, even though we've assumed the exact opposite. In the real world, terrorists rarely do get what they want, though they do sometimes extract partial concessions, while protest movements have a somewhat better success rate. Still not a stellar one, but better. Some have argued that this proves terrorism is ineffective, but that's an invalid conclusion. They may be right that peaceful protest is more effective, but the evidence we have available to us is not sufficient to establish that with any sort of confidence. So I think we need to take seriously the possibility that terrorism works, in the sense of giving groups a somewhat better chance of achieving some of their objectives than they'd have otherwise. How might that work? Well, on the next slide, I identify 5 different strategies. Some of these are pretty straightforward, others are not, but most of them have been at least partially successful at one time or another in the real world, and all of them have been attempted. Let's start with the simplest, the strategy of attrition. The goal here is to convince the target population that maintaining the status quo is going to cost them, with the hope that they therefore demand that their government grant concessions. An example of this would be radical Jewish groups such as the Irgun that carried out terrorist attacks on a limited scale and not resulting in a great number of casualties, but still terrorism by most definitions, against the British government in the 1930s and 1940s. Initially, the British government responded by trying to defeat the group. The attacks outraged the British public and attracted international condemnation. But it is widely believed that they strongly influenced the government's decision to terminate its mandate over Palestine. Did the UK grant Israel independence as the Irgun had hoped? No. But British forces withdrew, and Israel eventually did achieve its independence after a war against an Arab coalition. Next up, we have intimidation. The idea here is to convince the local population, those whom the terrorists claim to represent, that they'd be better off supporting the group, or at least not actively opposing it. An example of this would be much of the violence carried out by ISIS within the territory it controls. While they have also targeted Westerners, beheading American journalist James Wright and placing a video thereof on YouTube, most of their victims have been fellow Arab Muslims. They have made a particular point of executing those who support the Iraqi government, and they've done this most often in areas where their control is most tenuous, where the local population is most likely to see them as weak. One of the less intuitive strategies is provocation. Here, the goal is to draw the target government into military action. Why would terrorists want to be attacked? Well, a couple of reasons. One is that the population they draw support from is still on the fence. The more they can convince people that the target government is bad and must be opposed, the more recruits they'll have. The hope, then, is that in the resulting conflict, the government will also be responsible for the deaths of innocent civilians, but this time amongst the population the terrorists represent, and that this will encourage more people to take up arms against that government. The other is that counter-terrorist operations are extremely costly, and while they're likely to be popular in the short run, when the terrorist attacks are still fresh in everyone's mind, the public is likely to grow weary of them before they succeed. There's pretty good evidence that this was the goal of the 9/11 attacks, that bin Laden knew the U.S. wasn't going to abandon the policies he opposed on September 12th, but would instead go to war to defeat his terrorist network. What he hoped was that the U.S. would bankrupt itself in the process and eventually decide that maintaining a presence in the Middle East and providing such strong support for Israel wasn't worth it. If so, he sort of failed, but not entirely. The U.S. experienced a deep recession in 2008, one that spread to Europe and elsewhere, and there's pretty good evidence that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan contributed greatly to that. And until ISIS started dominating headlines, the U.S. public was starting to look pretty impatient with the war on terror. There was a lot of talk about disengagement from the region, pivoting to Asia, and so on. And the U.S. did withdraw forces from bin Laden's home country of Saudi Arabia. Did he succeed in ending U.S. influence in the region? No. But for a while there, it looked like he might come pretty close. A similar strategy is that of spoiling. Here, the goal isn't to start a conflict, but to ensure that one continues. Oftentimes, terrorist groups contain multiple factions, or multiple groups work towards the same goal. And it's not uncommon for governments to enter into peace talks with the more moderate faction or group while ignoring the extremists. When that happens, the extremists sometimes step up their attacks in hopes of derailing peace talks or preventing an agreement that's already been reached from being implemented. How do they benefit from stopping an agreement that involves some level of concessions on the very issue they care about? Well, by convincing the target government that a modest level of concessions won't buy them peace, that they can't just buy off the moderates and make the problem go away. If they want the violence to stop, they've got to give in to the demands of the extremists. An example of this is the Omaha bombing in 1998, which was meant to derail the Good Friday Agreement. As many of you know, the Irish Republican Army, or IRA for short, carried out attacks against the British government as well as unionists, or those believed to be unionists, in Northern Ireland. Their goal was to unite the island of Ireland under one government, to separate Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom. The Troubles, as this period was called, lasted for decades, claiming thousands of lives, before coming to an end, more or less, with the Good Friday Agreement. The British government didn't offer to let Northern Ireland secede and unite with the Republic of Ireland, as the IRA had hoped, but it did grant greater autonomy to Northern Ireland. The current system of devolved powers was established by the agreement, and that means that the people of Northern Ireland now live under policies set in London to a lesser degree, and Belfast to a greater degree, than was true prior to 1998. So in that sense, the IRA's campaign was partially successful, but not entirely. Thus, when the Good Friday Agreement was reached, the more extreme members of the IRA split off, forming what they called the real IRA, implying the rest were phonies who'd sold out. The single deadliest attack of the Troubles then took place. It didn't have the desired effect, though. Many believe it actually strengthened the peace process, and the real IRA issued an apology shortly thereafter. So this isn't an example of spoiling being successful, but it still illustrates the general concept, since the goal was pretty clearly to keep the conflict from ending, with the British government having offered only moderate concessions. That brings us to our last strategy, outbidding. Here, the goal is to convince the local population that the group carrying out the attacks is a better advocate for their interests than some other group, in hopes of siphoning away support. An example of this would be attacks carried out by Hamas in years past and Islamic Jihad today. One could certainly argue that Hamas employs the strategies of attrition, provocation, and spoiling as well, but many observers think that at least some of the motivation for their attacks, some of the time, is to convince Palestinians that they are the true face of the resistance. And, as Hamas has come to be seen as slightly more moderate, in that they've negotiated ceasefire agreements with Israel on more than one occasion, and demonstrated at least some willingness to abide by the terms thereof, even more extreme groups have risen to prominence, carrying out attacks during those ceasefires in the hopes of proving that they're more committed to the cause than even Hamas. Whether this strategy will ultimately result in an independent Palestine remains to be seen, but that's not the immediate short-term goal anyway. In the long run, that's what groups like Hamas are after, and they have made it clear in various statements and interviews that they see violence as a means to an end, rather than an end unto itself. But the strategy of outbidding is only meant to increase support for the group, and in that respect, it does appear to be successful. No one really talked about Hamas until the PLO recognized Israel's right to exist and formally renounced violence in 1993 during the First Intifada. Only by establishing themselves as the more extreme group, one that refused to recognize Israel, did Hamas gain prominence and support. Again, no one's arguing that terrorism is always effective. Some attacks, like the Omagh bombing, have failed miserably. Others have only been successful in achieving short-term goals, like drawing support away from a rival group, without having a discernible impact on the behavior of the government whose policies the group opposes. But, as I discussed earlier in the lecture, we probably shouldn't expect anyone to resort to such extreme measures, unless they're pretty desperate in the first place. And in some cases, specific attacks or prolonged campaigns have led to at least partial concessions. So while we might like to believe that terrorist attacks are never rewarded, that governments actually mean it when they say they refuse to negotiate with terrorists, history provides several examples to the contrary. I don't imagine many of you found this lecture uplifting, but I hope some of you found it enlightening.